My name is Jody Kretzman, and I'll say a couple of things about both this strange title and the session we're going to attempt here this afternoon, and also thank you all for coming in the first sunny moment we've had in the entire week. I don't know exactly why any of us are in this room at this point when the sun came out. We should be out enjoying it. I'm particularly pleased to see both the dear old friends in the room that go back 20 years, like Chris, and other old friends like Ken, who we've encountered each other for the last 5 or 6 years up at Holden, and Ken has never agreed with a word that I've said up here. It's really it's just refreshing to see you back again. So we'll look forward to some good give and take this afternoon, too. Let me say a word or two about what I bring to this discussion. I teach urban studies in Chicago to college students. That's fun to do, particularly if you love cities as I do, and if you most of the time love and the rest of the time can tolerate 20-year-olds, both of which I do. It has been that experience of teaching urban studies, teaching about the city, trying to respond to what the city has to teach us over the last 20 years has been a base to get us involved in lots of other things, including a lot of public policy issues, both locally in Chicago and nationally. Most of my work in economic policy has had to do with the city focus, as in fact most of my work as a social scientist has had to do with the city focus. So I bring a pretty heavy city bias to my discussion of anything current going on in the United States. You should know that. So I see the economy through the lenses of somebody who is primarily committed to the future of cities. I bring and I think thankfully, for your sake and for my sake, not the credentials of a professional economist. My own view as a sometimes professional social scientist of the economics branch of social science is that they really have done a good deal more harm than good, that the overall tendency of economics as a discipline to move in the direction of microeconomics, to move in the direction of quantitative modeling that attempts to take a whole lot of variables and then tell us what the future is going to be, has led us into a lot of dead ends. It has, for one thing, professionalized the field in a way that has made it absolutely mystical and distant, I think, to most lay people. So that folks who used to think they understood economies, people who worked in the household, people who worked in the factory, people who worked in the church, thought they understood what an economy worked like, how money came in, how labor was organized, what kind of exchange there was in a market. Lots of that sort of basic functional knowledge that everybody has now been sort of decertified by the fact that economics has become such an abstruse kind of profession. So I'm not a professional economist, and I think that if we are to act as informed citizens in relationship to any social problems that we address, that we have to retake the field of economics back, that somehow we need to reassert common sense economics. We have to reassert our own capacities to understand how an economy works. So part of my commitment has been both when I've been doing public policy work and when I've been doing organizing within and outside the church, has been to try to demystify economic categories and thinking. I guess the one other thing just to say is that I do come at these issues from a Christian point of view. We have here a factory in the making right below us, I guess. I do think it's possible to think about Christian perspectives in a variety of questions related to economics, and I hope maybe we might get a chance to talk a little bit about that toward the end of the session. All I want to do today is to seed some discussion and some thought, to go at the question of a quick cut analysis of the American economy in 1989, and to think that one can do that in 55 minutes, even with all of your help, is absolutely absurd. So I hope that you will accept the absurdity of that as we go into our discussion, and help me make the best of the 55 minutes. A word on the title. I was going to do, when we got up here at the beginning of the week, I was going to do a series of five sessions on different aspects of public life in America in 1989, with the overall title after the National Nap. The title came from a panel that I was involved with and on a couple of months ago, actually it was a debate format, myself up against Roger Rosenblatt. Roger used to be a columnist for Time, and he's now the editor at U.S. News and World Report. And Roger is a card-carrying, lifelong Republican, and I am a card-carrying, lifelong Democrat. And one of the many things, as it turned out, that we could agree upon was an assessment of the last decade or so, really a little bit more than that, I think, that says we've been living in a time and in a culture where most of the questions and most of the concerns have been defined in a very privatized and personalized way. And that's been true throughout the 1980s, that the way in which the Reagan administration, whatever you think about the Reagan administration, the way the Reagan administration defined the national reality was a way in which the categories that were most meaningful were personal and privatistic. That in fact, in economics, what that has meant was to restart or try to reinvent for the late 20th century the 19th century free market. That's the kind of experiment that's been going on for the last 10 years. One of the consequences of that is sort of the disappearance from our language and our thought over the last 10 years of all of the categories that have to do with the public good, all of the categories that have to do with citizenship, with obligations in the public, with the good of the community, so that the talk about this, what used to be called the civic discourse, the talk about publicness, about the good society or the great society, as we had Johnson call it in the late 60s, that kind of talk about the corporate public good has almost disappeared from our vocabularies, and it certainly disappeared from most of the policymakers' vocabularies and ways of thinking over the last 10 years. So that from the point of view of people who are concerned with the public good, we've been napping for about a decade. We've been napping while a variety of social concerns, public issues, additions to the civic agenda have been piling up. And I think that now is an assessment of where we are in 1989 as a sort of overall point of view that lots of Republicans would agree with, that for whatever the good that came out of Reagan's re-experimenting with the private market, it was clear that lots of major social issues, and Chris just did a session this morning on AIDS, which is one major example, and it's a major example within a much broader example of public health issues. It's been very difficult to talk about public health issues over the last 10 years and to think creatively as a society about how one might address that. That's not an isolated issue, I'm arguing here. It's been very difficult for us to take any of these public issues seriously. So, what originally was I was thinking about as a five-part series, that is to take a look at, under that rubric of the National Nap, the economy, our political life, right? Politics, both big P and small P, and then some particular areas which have been hard hit, it seems to me, in terms of accumulation of agendas that are unmet. Education is one. The environment, it seems to me, clearly is another. And probably healthcare in an overall sense. So the agendas, I'm arguing, have been piling up. And not out of any ill will have we as a nation been sleeping through the 1980s. Well, I think that's about to end. I think that I think that there's a kind of restlessness, and I want to test this with you a little bit today, and if some of you are still around Saturday when I do another one of these national map things on a different topic, race that time, to see whether you agree. My assessment is that the entire globe is moving in radically deep and structural ways, except for the United States. I mean, sometimes I wake up in the morning and wonder, right, with Eastern Europe and a variety of places in Asia and certainly China and all over Latin America and a variety of places in Africa, there are stirrings toward redefining the public good, toward finding something. There's kind of excitement about where we go next as a nation and nations all over the world. And the United States hasn't quite, we had that. We were the center of that kind of global activity in the 1960s, I think, for lots and lots of people. And in a different way in the 1940s and 50s. Somewhere in the mid-70s, it seems to me, we lost our sort of forward motion as a nation, and we became sort of incapable of the sort of creative leadership at the civic level that I'm thinking about now. I think that there's some stirring here, that there's the beginning now of some at least lots of sectors of the American public retaking these public issues seriously. At least that's my hope. Okay, that's sort of, does that make any sense? Are you with me so far? That's just sort of overall introductory stuff. Does that resonate? Does it sound absolutely nuts to anybody? Not yet. Thank you. Thank you, Dale. It probably does to Ken, but he's not going to tell me till later either. Okay, I want to do four things in the next 45 minutes then. I want to ask you to help me on the particularly the first one and the fourth one a lot. Number one, I'd like to hear some stories, and I'll try to direct some questions that tell us about what has happened to your local and regional economy over the last 10 years, okay? And work a little bit on relayicizing economic talk so that we can talk about that in ways we can all understand and maybe make some sense of and bring the questions into a kind of framework that we can deal with. Then I want to say just a few things about, I hope that they would be directed by what it is you tell us in the assessment of the local and regional economy, but I want to say a few things then about patterns in the overall American economy over the last decade. And then a little bit about some of the consequences of those patterns in the overall American economy. And finally, hopefully with lots of help from you here, some creative responses in terms of thinking about the economy for the 1990s. All right? What I'd like to ask you now is to see if we can put together, what I need to know is where people are from. What I'd like to do is to put together four or five quick snapshots of local and regional economies from 1979 to 1989 and see whether we've got the same thing happening in the four or five cities we pick or regions we pick or small towns we pick where you come from, or whether we've got different things happening and what kind of patterns we can pick up, okay? Help me construct a series of local and regional economies around questions that have to do with the labor supply, the labor market, ownership patterns, and other shifts and trends. Well, I'm going to specify those. What I'm going to ask you are some questions about major economic activity that was present in your town in 1979 that isn't there now. Loss of economic activity. Then I want to ask you about major economic activity that is present in your town now, 1989, that wasn't there in 79, economic growth. All right. Then I want to ask you about jobs. More or fewer jobs in your local than your regional economy. And where are they? And what kinds of jobs are they? And finally, I want to ask you to guess with me about what economists sometimes call a satisfaction index. That is, when you ask people in your congregation and in the broader community, are they better off now than they were in 79? What kind of answer do you get? Okay? Those kinds of questions. They're simple questions, and we're after guesses here. We're not after stuff that needs to be a social science verifiable. I'd like to do that for the four communities that have the most people represented here. Where are people from? Shout things out.
Quad Cities.
Quad Cities. How many Moline, Rock Island, et cetera people do we have here? A couple of those. Okay, there's two votes for Moline and the Quad Cities.
Greeley? Is a group from our city or something?
Greeley? Got a couple Greeley?
Yeah.
Alright, Seattle, Portland. Might as well do this out here.
I'm from
Quad Cities.
Washington. That'd be the Puget Sound.
That's Puget Sound, okay.
San Francisco and Reno.
the Twin Cities. Right. Okay. Quad Cities. For sure, Puget Sound, Quad Cities, Greeley, and where else do we have more than one from?
Reno.
Reno? Okay. Let's do Reno. Okay. Okay. Puget Land? Okay, let's draw some quick patterns. Let's do Seattle, Portland, or the Puget Sound, greater Puget Sound area, all right? The Quad Cities in Illinois, Rock Island, Moline, et cetera. Greeley,
Colorado.
And do we have more than one from Reno?
Two.
Two, okay, let's do Reno. Puget Sound, let's do, how many people from Puget Sound? Ten. One, two, three, four, five. All right. This is wonderful because these are all, except for the Quad Cities, these are all economies that I don't know much about. Tell me about Puget Sound people. Tell me about what's here in your economies in 1989 that was not there in 79. Computers, Boeing, what else?
Biotechnology.
Right.
Okay.
Logging.
Is it growing?
No.
We're talking about growing. We're talking about stuff that's really, it's booming from, booming in the 80s.
It isn't growing.
Fishing is down.
What? Not in Puget.
Come to Shelton and I'll show you.
Is it growing in the?
More export of logs than there's ever been before.
Okay, so within the region we've got some variation.
Right. I don't think we can draw. We can't say the same thing for fishing, though. That's just really a
What else is growing throughout the region? Besides, we've got biotech, Boeing, computers.
Yeah. Real estate is just
real estate. Okay.
Tremendous.
Right.
We've seen, what is somebody said, 12% growth every month or every 6 months. Just a fantastic amount.
Another big growing area is trade with the Pacific Rim and trying to expand our ties with the Pacific Rim.
Okay.
Exchange programs. Japan bought a college in Portland, so they can train.
Mm-hmm.
People are invested in college.
Okay.
The trip from Hong Kong, people are moving in. The Chinese are moving in into Vancouver, BC, and into Seattle and into Portland. And buying up just speculating so that they can invest their money. So that's another investment.
All right, international trade and investment.
Yeah.
All right. How about stuff that's gone or severely curtailed over the last decade?
Fishing has really gone down.
Fishing.
Foreign countries are vacuuming the bottom. It's taking everything. And leaving nothing to reproduce. That's a real problem.
And I take it the lumber industry is spotty then. Is that part of what you say? It's booming, booming and
running out of logs.
It's
so
local
sawmills might be right.
Local sawmills. The exports are still there with the local sawmills, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Shipbuilding.
A lot of people describe it as, they say about Oregon, that we're becoming a third world economy where we're shipping our national resources.
Interesting, yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, the raw logs.
Shipbuilding is down, you're saying?
Oh, yes.
Okay. What else was there in 79? drug economy? It's not. That's probably up, way up, huh?
Yeah, way up.
Okay, we'll take the informal economy as well as the formal economy.
In 79, you were building nuclear reactor over in that area.
Which is not...
Was terminated.
Yeah.
For lack of funds.
Okay, so nuclear is down.
Well, but, you know, for lack of funds. The people just refuse to spend any more money on that.
Is it the whoops story?
No, it's just political, but, right.
Okay.
Are growing.
All right, let's wait on government response. Okay, that's really sort of not directly economic activity. How about the jobs? We're going to have to subdivide this region locally here. From smaller towns to Portland and Seattle, get quick reports. More jobs now than in 79 or fewer?
More.
More in the Seattle area.
Many more, yes.
Many more in the Seattle area.
Tremendous influx of people coming in to fill up the jobs in the computer industry, and Boeing is tremendously hiring them.
All right, so jobs and population both up.
Mm-hmm.
Is along with that, are you also experiencing a rise in joblessness? Is the population outstripping the number of jobs available to them? Is that?
These are mostly skilled jobs.
Skilled jobs, okay.
Unskilled, there are very, very few. With the exception of those service jobs in Burger King's and McDonald's, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about in a smaller town, Ken? More jobs or fewer than 10 years ago?
More jobs.
More now?
More jobs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same. Any place out here experience a kind of shrinking economy? Any of the local areas within the region?
Lumber areas.
The lumber areas. We don't have anybody in the room from there, but,
no,
but that would be the sort of dying communities out here. Milltown.
Milltown.
Okay.
My wife's from a mill town in Oregon, Malala, and the high school gym burned down, and it took 5 years for them to finally decide that they're going to build a new one because there were people around.
All right. Finally, for the Puget Sound folks, if you were to do a sort of satisfaction index, if you were, let's start with members of your own congregation at this point, or at least very local community circle of folk. And they were to think about their own economic well-being in 1979 as compared to now, would they tell you it was better or worse, and why, do you think?
I think worse because the pay raises did not keep up with the absolute inflation. You know, inflation went up 5%, pay raises went up 4%. Year after year, we just didn't match one for one.
That's certainly true of the national scene.
And
the average family income has lagged behind inflation since about 75.
A college graduate coming out of college with a small amount of debt cannot, within 3 years, save up enough money to purchase a moderate loan from home because the price of home has gone up.
And those on fixed incomes, like the retired
anybody in education is not even keeping up with inflation.
But where you are?
Well, give me that question again.
If you would ask your neighbors and the people in your congregation if they were better off economically now than they were in 79, what would they tell you? Yeah.
Really,
because there's so many elements in it.
Our problem here in our church is meeting the budget, so we must be worth it.
Okay. Right. Just looking at the church itself, the congregation itself. All right. That's a good measure. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So you got all this boom going on here, but you've got at least large segments of the population that are not feeling themselves to be part of this boom. Interesting. That's interesting. Okay. Low on the satisfaction.
It's reflected in real estate, too. A lot of young folks that are just getting out of college who have paid off their debts and are married and want to
and buy a home, house prices have gone so high that young folks just can't afford to buy a home today, nor if there were any around.
Okay. Thank you, Puget Sound. Let's do a quickie through the Quad Cities. Help me out here, Quad Cities. It's two of you?
Who are the Quad Cities?
All right, Rock Island, go ahead.
Yeah, Rock Island. We had farm industry, and it's greatly diminished.
On the Illinois-Iowa border, right on the Mississippi, beautiful, beautiful setting, Rock Island, Davenport, Bettendorf, and Moline.
How many people total? Is this urban?
350,000.
Okay. Okay. Now, tell a story. Depressed economy.
Okay.
What left?
Some farm machinery left, but certainly not at the level that it was in 79.
What departed during the 80s?
Farm machinery.
Farm equipment.
International Harvester's gone.
Harvester was a big one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there anything else coming in?
I
cannot.
They're trying to get Riverboat Gambling in there.
That's
going to
be a
cure all. They're so desperate.
They're trying to enhance tourism.
Tourism and Riverboat Gambling. Reno, where are you with your story?
We don't like it.
Right. We should be talking to each other about that. Right.
Another thing in the Quad Cities in that area, there are a lot of small industries coming up. People that lost their jobs at Harvester and John Deere. A lot of them have ranked out into small industries.
Now that's interesting. What kind of small industries? What are they doing?
Well,
mom and pop kinds of operations.
But there are some pretty good sized ones in developing certain new equipment.
Are they
international?
Have they taken pieces of what International Harvester used to do in a big plant and sort of taken them little pieces out to do them in mom and shop ways? Is that one of the things that's been happening?
Like my son does painting and stuff, small parts for a certain industry. That's a new little industry.
Hmm. Okay.
So they're trying, but there isn't enough of that sort of thing.
The market for these smaller businesses is what? The larger businesses? Does he sell those parts to the bigger businesses?
He goes to companies that need these things done, so then it's like subcontracted.
It is subcontracted work, okay, for the most part. All right. What about anything else in the area growing in terms of jobs? Fast food stores, right.
Yeah.
All right.
Welfare.
All right.
And a lot of the farms have been taken over by big banks and sold out to foreigners.
Okay. So a lot of mortgages on the farms have been foreclosed, and the farm economy obviously is directly intertwined with the economy of the Quad Cities.
And a lot of people have sold their homes at great loss.
Yes.
And to leave.
Okay.
Family farms.
Mm-hmm.
The farms are still there producing, I think, to a large extent, but family farms are not.
Yep. It's clear that you're telling a story about job loss.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In all kinds of ways. What would people say? Does the general depressing story you're telling get reflected in how people feel about the economy?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They are...
That we're surprised, you know, to learn that it's going up anywhere else.
Is that
really?
Is that right?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So the satisfaction in the Quad Cities is also down.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Quick report from Reno, particularly since the Quad Cities is thinking about gambling.
It's a service economy.
It's entirely a service economy.
Almost entirely.
Okay.
Besides gambling, there's a warehousing industry because of certain tax breaks.
Uh-huh.
And we have a couple of small, well, I guess you would call them small, but say Porsche headquarters in Reno.
Well, that's
tourism. very, very heavy tourism. And then in the area, of course, there's mining, and that is on a roller coaster.
Yeah, mining is up and down, okay. But gambling, warehousing, and tourism is up. What's down?
Well, what's down is the small casino. Small casino.
Really?
Closed. Every season we have two or three closed, and the large hotel complexes are booming. Yeah.
All right.
Aggregate.
Population and jobs both on the way up?
Oh.
Still in Reno? Boom community
but
in lots of ways?
It's again difficult for unskilled labor. A lot of people come into Reno because they hear that there are jobs there, and
yeah.
then they end up on the street because they're not jobs for them.
Mm-hmm. And it's not an uncomfortable. If you're going to be on the street, it's the best place, one of the best
of
places
course.
To be on the street.
Yeah, and there are lots of unskilled jobs in the tourist industry, of course, but too many people want.
What would your friends say about the satisfaction index question? Better off now than they were in 79 or not? Going down.
Also, there are a number of people in our church who have recently come to Reno from other states like Idaho, Oregon, and so forth, and would rather be in Idaho or Oregon, but need to come to Reno for the job. So
uh-huh.
Not everyone's there because they want to be.
Okay.
Those from the Midwest like that.
Okay. All right.
Could people in the Northwest add a couple more things?
Sure.
We've forgotten about the defense industries in the Puget Sound area. We've got Fredericton and Bangor, the substation, and we have Whitby. We have a new base going into Everett, which is really impacting the economy upward. Of course, the tourism, too, is another thing you've forgotten to put down. So.
That's also up there,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. That's the third time we've written that.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. It says something about disposable income, too, from someplace. What's a quick report from Greeley? Give us a quick Greeley, Colorado picture. You're on the range. You're in the mountains, right?
No, we're on the plains.
On the plains?
Yeah, in the plains. Farming is...
The agricultural area.
Mm-hmm.
Oil industry.
Mm-hmm. What's growing?
Well, agriculture is coming back. Oil industry is slowly coming back.
Hewlett Packard, IBM, Kodak, a lot of high tech industries type thing in the region, not in Greeley itself.
Okay. What's gone that was there in 79?
Just a lot. The farms, the farms have tended to, small farms have
been absorbed into larger ones?
Absorbed into
corporate
larger
farming?
Farms.
Okay. All right. What's your overall population trend? You going up in the number of jobs keeping pace?
Going up.
Yeah.
Going
gradually.
Gradually, bro. Not
okay.
Not moving.
All right. And how would people in your community or congregation answer the question about satisfaction compared to 79?
Pretty up.
Better? Better than?
And the professional people are better, and their menial labor is probably a little worse.
Okay.
I mean,
first time somebody's made that sort of class distinction. That's important to make.
Chain stores are coming in with, instead of hiring full-time help, they're hiring part-time help without the benefits. And that's the trend in the number of businesses.
Okay.
In
the
area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Satisfaction goes both ways depending on where you are. Okay.
Not only have quite a few labor-type people and had the better drawing real life salary.
Uh huh. Uh-huh.
Probably in the 5 and 6 figures.
This is interesting. I think I'm a little bit I'm interested in the number of parallels we're getting here in really very, very different parts of the country in different economic settings. Let me make a couple overall comments about maybe some of the stuff that we see up there, and think about where we heard these in the last 10, 15 minutes. I've got five quick things that seem to me to characterize where we are in 1989 in terms of the economy. They're very simple things, but that's at least notably different than where we were in 1979 and has affected, I think, all of our lives in each of these cities and regions in different ways. Number one, I think much more than we're used to in the American economy, we're experiencing what the economists have come to call uneven development. Uneven development, boom and bust. We talked a lot about cycles in particular sectors and industries here, but it also affects localities within regions. I see it in cities all the time because the way uneven development works in most cities is that you've got booming, gleaming downtowns all over the place. It's true in Seattle and Portland, I know, and it's certainly true even in the back east cities. Chicago has an incredibly marvelous downtown. All virtually two-thirds of it anyway rebuilt in the last 20 years. Now, cheek by jowl next to absolute poverty, right? So that in another way, we're looking more and more third world in our cities. That is that appearance within the cities of the very wealthy and the very poor, and the disappearance of the working and middle classes, right? So that geographically, we have this kind of uneven development, as well as by sector. Right? So that one of the major things it seems to me that's escalating in terms of our economic reality is these varieties of uneven development. And that would call for some different ways of thinking about how to respond to that. I mean, there ought to be some ways of propping up, if it's in the public good, to do that. We can decide as a society that it's worth doing that to preserve jobs and communities, some ways might be found, be looked for, to prop up industries that we know are going to be part of the bust cycle, or places that are part of the bust cycle. So, sort of macro pattern number one, it seems to me increasingly uneven development. Also, I think what we're seeing, and we heard more about it in Puget Sound than any others, although with Quad Cities is a part of it too, is hugely increased mobility of capital, right? Everybody knows this, right? Larger companies now can think about the entire globe as their investment ballpark, right? They're no longer rooted in a place in the way that they used to be. I could spend days talking about this one because it seems to be absolutely central to rethinking what it is we do in congregations and in communities. If our entire economic life no longer is rooted in a place, right, how can we then think about an economic life that is linked to the building of community, right, and the sort of fostering of better human community? It seems to me that's a huge challenge for churches and communities to look at. Capital mobility obviously has some patterns. A lot of it has gone into the West and the Southwest within the United States. A lot of these growth industries in Puget Sound have their investment capital coming in from other parts of the country. And it's also gone overseas. The third macro pattern it seems to me that we see here, and everybody has talked about it, we now live in what we can all agree at least is a post-industrial economy. Everybody here talked about the disappearance of industrial jobs, right? And the growth of service sector jobs. The growth of jobs where nobody makes anything, right? I sometimes challenge my students to go into downtown Chicago, a place where 550,000 people congregate every day to work in the downtown loop, and to find me anybody in downtown Chicago who makes something, who actually produces something, makes something other than money, that's right. And it's almost an impossible task for them. They can't find anybody. Obviously, those downtowns are not about making things. They're about pushing a paper or pushing computer chips in a variety of ways. I think within that development, clearly from industry to post-industry or service economy, that we're beginning to be aware, and we heard about it in Greeley, I think we've heard about it in Quad Cities, and to some degree in Puget Sound and Reno as well, that the new service economy has two tracks to it. That there's a high-tech, well-educated, good-paying, professional track, right? And that there's a low track into the McDonald's, the sort of McDonaldization of work, which is dead-end, low-pay, minimum wage, no advancement. The less education, the better in lots of ways. And McDonald's doesn't want people who are educated and therefore think for themselves. So you've got a kind of bifurcated new segment of the economy appearing in all of these areas. And one of the things that has meant, number four, it seems to me, is a huge increase huge change in the character of poverty in the United States. Also in the 1980s, an increase in the number of poor people and in the rate of poverty, but a change in the character of poverty in the United States. We hear about it most in relationship to cities when people talk about the underclass, which is a term I don't like to use, but it refers to a set of realities, it seems to me, that are economically caused and understandable within economic terms. It is the people who are locked out even of that bottom sector of the new service society, right? The people who for reasons of geography, for reasons of race, often are in an economic setting that doesn't even let them get up into that bottom part of the service economy, right? It has also led to, it seems to me, another part of the fourth set of consequences or fourth set of developments, a clear increase in the number of working poor. That is, in order for families who are caught in this bottom part of the service sector to make it, clearly both parents have to work, right? If both parents for some reason can't work, that is, if the family is headed, for instance, by one parent, then that family, even though the parent works, will fall into poverty, right? As defined generally by the Census Bureau. So there's a different kind of poverty. There's a poverty that seems to me to be asking quite different questions about our old myths about mobility in the United States, about it being possible for everybody to put their wheel to the grindstone and make it in the United States. It could be that we need to reconceive local economies before we can think once again about the doors of opportunity being open to the poorest people in the country. And finally, the fifth thing it seems to me that affects all of us, and you've all talked about this, I think, in different ways, is simply the increase in the size of our major enterprises. It's related to the capital mobility point. It's related, I think, also to the uneven development point. But somewhere in the 80s, it seems to me, in the merger mania of the major corporations, we have crossed some kind of Rubicon. We've got ourselves into a different kind of economy where, for the first time, you have organizations which are really beholden not even to any national state, right? That the new mega corporations, the new transnational, multinational corporations, are something new on the face of the earth. We have not seen economies organized in this way before. And they raise huge new questions for us. They are beyond the scope and the reach of anything, any public body, any place. Therefore, they can use the entire globe as their sort of economic realm. And in fact, they can use the entire universe as their economic realm. And that has changed things a lot, I think. Well. Are those clear? I mean, just quick. Just obviously some common sense kind of things there, I think. Well, I think that, that those factors are related to some of the huge economic agendas, economic cost agendas, social agendas that have piled up on us since the late 1970s. And I've just, this could go on for weeks, but I've just listed a few sets of indicators that, that are meaningful to me anyway in the areas of crime and health and education and housing, poverty rates, mm-hmm. And the deficit that that indicate to me that somehow our lack of capacity to retool, to rethink what's going on in our economic life is simply piling up a whole series of crises which we're going to have to pay for at some point. The crime scene is incredible. I love the statistic about 800 new beds in prison. If you want a growth industry, you're right, get a prison. 800 new beds a week are being built and needed in the United States. We now have the largest percentage of our population in prison that we've ever had in our history as a country, and the largest percentage of any industrial nation except for South Africa.
The largest number of lawyers.
Also the largest, thank you. Directly related. I agree with that, Ken. That's obviously related to the structure of that bottom half of the service economy and the growth of whatever it is we call the locked out underclass. Right. One economic solution that makes absolutely no social sense is to build more prisons, and that's exactly what we're doing. That's the social policy answer so far. Health, Chris, you could go through the horror stories over and over again in the public health area. We're, I think now, something like 19th in infant mortality among the developed, so-called developed nations of the world. We're behind places like Singapore and Spain, often thought of as slightly more backward places in infant mortality. And those trends are all downward. There are now at least 37 million without health insurance, without any access to health care.
I see another trend there, but with the mental health people, at least in, since 79, they've solved the problem of those mental health institutions by putting them out into the street and closing the institutions, and now they're doing the same thing with mentally retarded, at least in this state, and they've done it in California and several other states back east, where they're closing those institutions and trying to put those people in the streets where obviously they'll just die or disappear.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that is the philosophy that we've had in the last 10 years.
Yeah. And that could be another example of a well-motivated set of policies to deinstitutionalize people out of institutions that were clearly...
Now you no longer have a problem because you close the institutions and they're out into the street, so there's no problem there.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Education, you know the education story. The Reagan administration, I think, has been good in pointing out the education story to us and less good in doing anything about it. We're now, one of the interesting factors, it seems to me, is that the United States is last in all of the sciences in terms of the testing for secondary school graduates, at least in a survey of 13 industrialized nations. About 18% drop out of high school nationally, of course much higher in numbers of cities, and another 18%, interestingly enough, on most literacy tests flunk. This is another 18% of those people who actually graduate from high school have trouble reading their diplomas. In fact, the general housing crisis you know about, the increasing gap between people who need housing and people and the number of affordable units that people can get to. We talked a little bit about poverty. One of the factors in that not only is the situation with women, but with children. Now we've got about 1 in 5 children overall born into poverty in the United States. If you're Hispanic. Your chances, if you're a Hispanic child, are 1 in 3 being born into poverty. If you're Black, 1 in 2. Many more working poor, up to 9 or 10 million at this point. And then we have the twin deficits, both the international trade deficit and the budget deficit. Interestingly, on the national debt, $157 billion per year is now the bill for interest on the $2.8 trillion national debt, three times larger than it was in 1980 when Reagan took office.
Joe, yeah. What I'm hearing is you agree with the statement that we read from time to time that the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer.
I think that's right. All of the trends show basically, I was going to do a little poverty chart here, but progress in eradicating poverty peaked in the United States in about 77. It leveled off till about 81. Then in the depression of recession of 82, 83, the gap between the rich and the poor widened significantly, and the poor got much poorer and more numerous. And since 83, the downward trend of the situation of poor people has continued but leveled off a little bit, and we've made no recovery for poor people since 83.
So what has happened then to the middle class, the backbone of our system?
More and more of the middle class are dropping through into at least very close to poverty.
Yeah. Or is it being moved upwards? So
and well, there certainly is some reality to the yuppie myth, right? This was not made up out of whole cloth.
The middle class used to be able to go out and buy a home, and now when you sell your home, you go out and buy another home in a different city, it's a real hassle.
That's right.
Middle class.
That's right.
So if I can one indicator. Sell my middle class home in Washington, move to California, and get the equivalent middle class home.
Well, that's true on those coasts, but it's not true in central part of
the Rock Island.
Yeah. A lot of houses available, really nice houses in Rock Island available.
How about the mountains back there?
Which is interesting because a lot of the corporations have headed for the coasts, and a lot of their workforce can't afford to follow them there. So that as capital becomes more mobile, the workforce becomes less mobile in some ways because they can't afford to follow the corporations. And I think that's one of the issues, in fact, that is getting industry interested in these issues. There's some clear self-interest involved there. Well, let's finish by talking a little bit about some possible creative responses here. It seems to me that there's something about being a Christian in the public realm at this point that brings us some special identities and presents us with some special kinds of challenges. It seems to me clearly that there has to be some concern among Christian people for the least of those among us. And for how it is we think about an economy that produces more poor people rather than eliminating poverty. Certainly the New and Old Testament tell us about that. There is also, though, I think less obviously, a couple of other themes that we might really think about in relationship to the economy. It seems to me that Christian folks know something about the value of community that needs to be re-injected into our thinking about about the economy. Self-worth is really not simply an individual kind of thing, that it is a community set of issues, and that thinking about the good community is something that Christian people and communions of saints might be more about. We might think then that a Christian challenge in terms of the economy would lead us to look for structures and ideas and policies that promote economic justice and that build community and that finally enable something we might think about as good work. It seems to me that one other consequence of the way we've thought about the economy in the 1980s is that the quality of work and the purpose of work has dropped out of our conversation. That work for the for simply the end of making money or simply the end of enhancing leisure that is not working is more and more what people understand work to be, and that seems to be less and less probably a biblical concept of what work might be. It seems to me that throughout throughout both the Old and New Testament, we're confronted with a conception of work that is much more whole than that. That work has to do with building the human community, that it has to do with fulfilling God's creation in lots of ways. That there needs to be, therefore, some connection between what it is we do in our work and a product. Right? That we need to have some kind of conception that what it is we do has some social meaning, has some meaning that enhances community. So that the third element of a Christian approach to the economy then has something to do with enabling and sustaining good work. So concern for the poor, concern for community, enablement of good work. Finally, it seems to me that Christian congregations might be able to radically alter the way in which people think about their work and the economy simply by being as traditional as they can possibly be. What I mean is that two sort of factors that inform the parish are a commitment to place, right, and a long view. If we were to take seriously in our economic life a commitment to place, a commitment to locality, and a long view of the sustainability of our economic life, right, it seems to me that we would find ourselves in some conflict with the majority of developments that we're describing in our overall economic system. So what I'm arguing is that let's be good conservative Christians, right? And we will turn out to be radical economic critics. Good conservative Christianity will turn us into economic radicals if we take time and space, as they're understood biblically, seriously. And I don't know, it seems to me as we go into the 1990s, the end of the 20th century, that's a wonderful set of, exciting set of challenges for local congregations and Christians working in community to work on. Almost all of the excitement I see about stuff going on in the economic realm is very local, very rooted, very much a part of people's everyday lives in a world that is miles removed from the Boeings, miles removed from the world of international finance. And it would be a wonderful set of challenges, it seems to me, to take on for the churches, to reroute and sort of re-eternalize our thinking about the economy. Well, that bell meant dinner, probably, right? I wanted to talk about that with you. Okay, come and get me, Ken.
Are you a capitalist?
Oh, I don't think capitalism exists. I'm not against it. It just doesn't exist.
Look, you're only variable. And now, what's the last one? You forgot $250. No. This friend of mine, or I have two friends, you know how many they put out? 4,000 homes a year. Each one of them. And we're into mass production. This one potato farmer that I know, he has 9 sections, and he furnishes potatoes. I always thought potatoes. No, I never thought potatoes are potatoes because I've been cooking all my life. But when there's a certain variety of potatoes they plant for potato chips and french fries and everything, and when they get to that deal, they spray them, and then they dig them, and they're, when they cultivate them, we, back in our day, it was a 2-row cultivator. Now, gee whiz, 8 to 10 rows at a time. And when they harvest, the same thing. And the same thing all over in the Midwest. And we're hitting the same thing in our Washington state. We used to go out and, well, first they had the misery whip. Now it's a chainsaw. And the chainsaw is
passé. That's old-fashioned.
Right.
What we're doing, we have a machine that goes hot. It cuts a big tree off, lays them in a pile, and they come along with a grapple and they haul them in. And I don't know.
That's a long way from the family farm, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, now, you bet.
And it's clearly got some consequences. It's got some consequences not only for the economic organization,
Japan,
but for the land.
Japan beat that family farm concept by kicking the price of rice up to $10 American dollars a pound. Mm-hmm. So that the little rice paddy farmer can make a living on his little rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
They, he can go to work for a combine, or he can go to work in the shipyards, or he can go to work for Nippon Electric or something else in the city off the farm. And that's where the heart. This is what I hear you saying. This is the middle class that we're talking about, whether it's Japanese, not that they have a middle class, but it's the United States middle class, that is being eradicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're talking about mega production of potatoes, a mega production of hogs. How many little guys are doing that today? None.
None. That's all they can.
That's the middle class. And that's the backbone of our United States.
They're wiped out.
They're wiped out.
And I don't know what has caused all of this.